Hello and welcome to the Blue Plaque Pod. My name is Cassia St. Clair and I am joined by Kit Kemp MBE. Kit is an interior designer, the founder and creative director of Kit Kemp Design Studio and Fermdale Hotels. She is known for championing British art and craft and for her colourful, eclectic and much imitated style. So because this is a podcast about blue plaques, I wondered if, first of all, you could imagine that at some point in the future, you have a blue plaque for yourself somewhere, the Kit Kemp blue plaque. Can you describe where this blue plaque would be? It's got to be somewhere really important to you, you know, your a birthplace or a childhood home, where you first had your first job, somewhere that really means something.
It would be 269 Old Brompton Road. It was the first flat that I ever stayed in London. It was quite a dilapidated building until an architect I worked for got hold of it. And there was a clock outside, which was created by someone called Mr. Late, which we always thought was such a great name, clockmaker. Apparently, he sort of died in the basement, which was rather damp. And, you know, the water was leaking through it. But by the time the architect, Leszek Nowicki, had finished with it, it was a most beautiful building again.
Usually blue plaques, because they're relatively small, they only have a very small amount of space in which to describe someone. So what would be, in just a few words, how would you describe yourself?
Loves colour.
I approve. That's a good one.
Makes me happy. Spices up your life.
And would this be an official circular blue plaque, or would it be a kind of a jazzier one? Would it be, you know, there are some great rectangular brown ones with ornamental leaf detailing. What are we looking at here?
Well, actually, it would be bright orange and look like a sort of crest, you know, like a stamp. Actually, that's my logo anyway, with two Ks on it. I think we'd go orange today.
Okay, so now that we've established your blue plaque, or orange plaque, we're going to travel to a slightly different part of town to visit the plaque that you've chosen to talk about. And this is located at 6 Gordon Square in Bloomsbury in Camden in London. And the wording for this one, it reads, Vanessa Bell, 1879 to 1961, Duncan Grant, 1885 to 1978, artists lived and worked here. And it was actually, it's a really recent one. It was only erected in 2023. And it's one of the sort of rare plaques that is actually the sort of one of two on this particular house. And the other one is for the economist John Maynard Keynes. So to start off, Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant, to talk a little bit about them in sort of general terms, they were really prominent artists of the time who enjoyed this very long and fruitful creative and romantic partnership that lasted nearly 50 years. They were members of the Bloomsbury Group and also directors of the Omega Workshops, which produced furniture, pottery, textiles designed by young artists, including themselves. Vanessa was born Vanessa Stephen, and her sister Virginia would become better known as the writer Virginia Woolf. And she would marry Clive Bell, an art critic and fellow Bloomsbury Group member, in 1907. And this house, where the blue plaque is, at 46 Gordon Square, is actually kind of the epicentre of the Bloomsbury Group. Can I ask why you chose this plaque in particular to talk about?
I chose it because I'd always heard about the Bloomsbury Group. But I became interested when we built the Charlotte Street Hotel, which was in Charlotte Street. And I realized, and that this was in about 1999, and the Bloomsbury Group were a bit out of favor at that time. So I was able to go to auctions and actually get to know their work and other artists working with Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant at that time. Walmark, Henry Lamb, Roger Fry, of course. So when I was asked to choose the blue plaque, I thought Bloomsbury is my area because I've been working around there and I always get to know the area more when we're building something. Vanessa actually has been one of my heroines. I felt that she was slightly overlooked in her lifetime, but that's changing now. She had her sister, Virginia, who had her problems. She suffered nervous breakdowns and was very, very fragile as a character. And it seems to me that Vanessa was the one person that sort of held so many people in this group together. but also Duncan Grant, who she worked with and got on with terribly well. It's good that their plaque is shared together.
Something that I like to do with this podcast when we're sort of thinking about trying to sum up people's lives is to try and pick out sort of three key moments from, you know, the life or lives of the people commemorated. It's really interesting with this one because there are two people commemorated on the plaque. The first sort of obvious one is to talk a bit about their backgrounds. And for Vanessa, she was born into this very kind of intellectual circle. Her father was Sir Leslie Stephen, who was a writer and scholar. He was the first editor of the Dictionary of National Biography, and he edited the Cornhill magazine. And the family grew up in Kensington. And the four children, Vanessa, Virginia, Toby and Adrian, were all born in Kensington, but they actually end up moving to Gordon Square after the death of their parents when Vanessa's in her early 20s. And Duncan Grant's childhood is completely different. He was born in Scotland. Much of his childhood was spent in India. And his parents really wanted him to have a career in the army. And of course, he had very different ideas and flung himself into the study and practice of art. I wondered if you thought that their sort of parentage and their upbringings was kind of a key moment for them, and how you kind of reflected on their two very different set of circumstances.
I think it's very interesting. Brought up in Hyde Park Gate, but women were subjugated in a way. I think the boys went to Cambridge. Toby was part of a little group there called the Secret Apostles. And members of the group were Leonard Woolfe, Clive Bell, E.M. Forster, John Maynard Keynes. And these are all people that we get to know later. But I feel that Virginia and Vanessa felt slightly stifled at home. In 1904, when Sir Leslie Stephen died, the mother had already died and a sister, Stella, had also died. So, you know, there was a lot of upheaval within the house. But this was a brave new world. And they went to Bloomsbury, and Bloomsbury at that time was somewhere where young ladies really didn't live. I mean, if you came in your hansom cab or whatever it was, the driver wouldn't really want to drop you there. So it was an exciting time for them. And of course, Toby was bringing his friends back to 46 Gordon Square as well. And that was an exciting time. So he started something called the Thursday Club. And I feel almost in retaliation, Vanessa decided to have the Friday Club. And the Friday Club really was more sort of female artists, rather than John Maynard Keynes and Lytton Strachey, who was always saying something quite outrageous for the boys. And it's quite interesting because historically there are many ways. I've read that this was more like sort of tea and buns and sitting on the floor. And then you hear other accounts where it was much more sort of bawdy, and the word queer had come up for the first time. So people were being much more honest, much more straightforward. They were trying to get away off the straitjacket of Victorian life. And I think she really embraced that.
Yeah, I think definitely that move to Gordon Square and the origins of the Bloomsbury Group are so interesting because, yes, they move from this quite fashionable part of town to a new place in London. And it's all about, or it becomes all about, kind of throwing off these constraints of Victorian, straight-laced, upper-middle-class society and social conventions. And you get this gathering of like-minded people that, and Vanessa Bell in particular really sort of seems to form the epicenter. She's kind of like the kernel around which the pearl forms, if that makes sense. You know, they're all sharing ideas, they're supporting each other's creative and intellectual endeavours, even if they're, you know, what they're doing are quite different. It's really difficult, almost impossible, to describe the relationships between the various members without getting into a real muddle. The writer Dorothy Parker described them as a group that lived in squares and loved in triangles. And somewhere online, when I was trying to sort of neatly sum up the relationships that developed between various members of the group, I found a great illustration of all the connections that looked a little bit like a tube map, and I'll probably link it in the show notes. But essentially, you know, everyone was sort of having affairs with everyone else or getting married to everyone else. Suffice it to say that this group that begins to gather at 46 Gordon Square around Vanessa and her sister was one that adopted fluid sexual identities and family structures and begins to produce extraordinary creative and intellectual output and attracts really sort of intellectually curious and adventurous people. And Duncan Grant's sort of entree into the group is a great example of that. He was introduced to the group by his cousin and lover, we've already mentioned, Linton Strachey. And in fact, most of his lovers were men and included John Maynard Keynes. So this kind of fomenting life almost as an artistic experiment seems to be really pivotal to understanding who they were and the work that they produced.
I think that a lot is made of that. And one forgets just how serious they were as artists. I think it was Lytton Strachey's mother who encouraged Duncan as well as Simon Bussey. And he went at the age of 17 to the Westminster School of Art. And then he went over to Paris for a year. He actually met Matisse and later Picasso. And then he went to Italy for another year. I mean, art was central to his life. And the same with Vanessa. I think Vanessa was very serious about all that she undertook. And in a sense, the relationships are made too much of, I think, really. And I think Roger Fry really did love Vanessa Bell. Vanessa's brother, Toby, died in I think it was 1906, of typhoid, which he caught in Greece. And she, almost on the rebound, married Clive Bell, who I suppose you would say was one of the intelligentsia, and he was a very well-respected art critic. But it probably wasn't the right turn to have got married. When she met Roger Fry, apparently she met him on a train. And, of course, he was bubbling with ideas, having come back from America. He really was so important because he brought the post-impressionists to England at the Grafton Gallery in 1910, which everybody hated. Everybody was absolutely up in arms about how anybody could possibly like this work. But then it was so exciting for Vanessa and Duncan to see this is the way forward. This is how we want to be. And this is how our art is going to progress. So it was a very exciting time. So many things were happening.
And almost the group and the relationship between the group members allowed them to push the boundaries of their art, you know, because there was a lot of restrictiveness in society at the time. You know, we're still in the shadow of the Criminal Law Amendment Act, which was rushed through Parliament in 1885 and criminalised homosexual sex in England, regardless of consent. And then you get this kind of very fiercely scathing reaction to modern French art. And there's something about this group forming that have created their own rules that allows for greater experimentation, where they are allowing each other to experiment in multiple different ways and to build sort of really exciting creative partnerships, which I think is the sort of the third thing that I wanted to talk about from both their lives, is this incredible creative partnership that they form, you know, that lasts for 5 decades. They're painting side by side in the same room. When Vanessa gets pregnant with Duncan Grant's child, their only child that they have together, he's sort of painting the walls and fireplaces and various parts of the house that they're in, while she's sort of on the sofa looking on. But you know, when she's well and she's able, they're painting side by side. They're both directors of the Omega Workshops, and they're producing kind of pottery, textiles, and other applied arts. And Grant moves into 46 Gordon Square, and then later Grant and Bell move to Charleston in Sussex. And here again is a kind of new canvas, a new place for them to express themselves creatively. And again, they decorate the entire house in this incredible styles that they work on together. Part of this move is to help him avoid being prosecuted for not joining the war effort. This is the First World War, because you can do farm work during the war without being prosecuted for being a conscientious objector. This is kind of, you know, part of the reason why they move. But through the war and after it, they're regularly producing joint exhibitions. They, you know, they're decorating their own homes. They take on commissions. They're in really great demand as artists and illustrators and designers. And both of them continue to paint up until their deaths. Bells in 1961 and Grant's in 1978. And they're actually buried next to each other in the churchyard near Charleston in Sussex, where they spent so much time. But I think it's incredible that they have this very long, very fruitful creative partnership, which both allows them to develop in tandem. You know, there's a similarity to their style, but they also have this, you know, separate identities and separate successes.
Yes, that's very true. I think the Omega workshop was a great idea. Roger Fry felt that lots of young artists were nearly starving in their garrets. And so his idea was that if they worked a couple of days a week making things for the home, then it would give them a little bit of extra money so that they could afford to live and to actually paint. So it was a means to an end, as well as making people's homes much more decorative and brought murals into it all. There's something here. I love it when Vanessa is at home and I was interrupted yesterday by Duncan, who came in and lay on the floor and talked in a desultory but cheering way of how we are to turn my studio into a tropical forest with great red figures on the walls, a blue ceiling with birds of paradise floating from it, and curtains, each one different. This is all to cheer us through London winters. Duncan also wants a bath let into the floor, but I told him that was a la Dayton House, which made him rather cross.
That's such a brilliant image of a domestic life lived in such a different way and such a wonderful relationship that the two had.
Yeah, I think so, because she was Vanessa, although she was rather stately and really quite beautiful, I think, there was always this nervousness as well. And I feel that Clive Bell, her husband, was not a relaxing person to be with. Roger Fry was always bubbling with ideas, but Duncan made her feel relaxed. She could understand him. They could both work together. And so I think this was another reason for their everlasting friendship. They really enjoyed one another's company. But more than that, they just really could relax, like being with, your friend who feels like an old shoe.
That's a very nice way of putting it. Are there any moments, any sort of key moments that you would select if you really wanted people to understand the dynamic between the two and who the two people are and their relationship?
I always think it's wonderful to hear what Virginia says, because Virginia was the writer and she could put together so many beautiful sentences. And she actually talks about what she thinks of Duncan. And she says, "I never saw a more remarkable figure than that adorable man, dressed in a nonconformist minister's coat, but under that an astonishing mixture of red waistcoats and jerseys, all so loose that they had to be hitched together by a woolen belt, and braces looping down somewhere quite useless. He is more and more like a white owl perched upon a branch and blinking at the light and shuffling his soft furry feet in the snow. A wonderful creature, you must admit, how though he ever gets through life, but as a matter of fact, he gets through it better than any of us."
That's a really lovely description, but also makes him sound very kind of old and woebegone. And actually like Vanessa, was incredibly beautiful. If you look at photographs of them and the paintings, they are very attractive people.
I don't think that they ever sort of dined out on that. And obviously, I think Duncan Grant, you've heard of a femme fatale. He was an homme fatale, as far as I can work out. When they moved to Charleston, it was actually as a triangle, because he was with his lover, David Garnett, as well. But nevertheless, it did seem to work. And I think Vanessa could always make a home feel comfortable. She had that humanity about her that when people came to stay, they never wanted to leave. There are lovely stories about John Maynard Keynes coming to Charleston farmhouse, and he had bought a Cézanne when he was in Paris, but as it was a long walk to the house, he put it in a hedge and walked up. And then when he'd arrived, after about half an hour, he said, "Oh my goodness, I think I've just left this painting in a hedge down there. We better go and get it before it starts raining." And, you know, incredible things like that, that they just sort of took for granted.
Oh, what a life and what a way to live. What do you think that they, you know, Vanessa Bell and Duncan Grant would make of the way that they have been commemorated? Would this plaque in this place be something that would mean much or anything to them?
I think they would like it. I really do. I mean, Virginia had plaques everywhere, and Hogarth Press probably, and Leonard Woolf, and really, they deserve it just as much as anybody else. And I think Vanessa was forgotten even more than Duncan Grant towards the end of her life. And yet, when you look at the works now and the book, I think, that Richard Schoen published about Bloomsbury, suddenly you realise just what a force she was.
And the fact that she did create these epicentres, the fact that she managed to bring these people together and create the conditions under which so many different people were able to create their best work and live these, you know, wonderful lives where you're leaving Cezanne's in Hedges, is testament to her power. Maybe it's not something that is easily described or easily summed up in a plaque, but to have created, to have been the epicentres for these groups is incredible.
I mean, she sounds very soft, but then when you hear what Leonard Woolf said about her, I mean, he thought that she appeared frightening and rather formidable. So she was so many different things to so many different people, I think, and they saw her in a very different way. He said, "I never found her formidable, partly because she had the most beautiful speaking voice that I've ever heard, and partly because of her tranquility and quietude. The tranquility was to some extent superficial. It did not extend deep down in her mind. For there in the depths, there was also an extreme sensitivity, a nervous tension."
I think I need to find some good friends who can write profound, wonderful and beautiful things about me, because I'm worried that in a couple of centuries, if anyone is talking about me, there won't be anything nearly so wonderful.
That's the thing, Cassia. At that time, people wrote wonderful letters. They don't do that now. We're all on email. So they wrote the most beautiful, long, incredible letters. I mean, Dora Carrington, I think some of her letters were absolutely glorious as well.
Are there things about this pair that have, you know, that learning about them, thinking about them, having a hotel near the kind of epicentre of the Bloomsbury group, are there things about them that have changed the way that you think about your own work as a designer and even your own life and the way that you live your life?
Definitely. Their sensibility about the colours that they used. I love the Bloomsbury colours. I call them Bloomsbury colours because there's always a little tiny bit of lamp black in it. If you looked at a sort of Picasso blue in the Mediterranean, it looks entirely different when you get it into an English light. And I think that Vanessa and Duncan really understood our English light. And so all the colours that they choose look wonderful here. They might not look as wonderful, actually, if they were in the tropics or even in the Mediterranean, but they work beautifully here.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose if you're trying to think of a way of describing them as a family, I sort of think you'd maybe call them broken colours, which sounds like a rather mean description of them. But there is something about them that has this, you know, they all have this kind of addition of black, as you say, and they're kind of, they suit the northern light.
Yes, they do. And we asked someone called Alex Holweg to paint some murals because we found some editions of Illustrated London Life from about 1912. And it was glorious women coming out of the tube station with big fur coats on and looking terribly glamorous. And we asked Alex to do scenes from everyday life, but it was in the year 2000. But he did them all in the Bloomsbury colours. And he understood that so well because he was related to Edward Wadsworth, and he loved Rivelius and painters like that as well. I just feel that there was a certain feeling around that time. And to get all their work together is such an exciting thing. And it was another movement, you know, bringing in Catherine Hamnett and people like that as well, who were sort of zany, very different characters, and they were not going to be held down. And I think the women also were fighting and coming into their own.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Blue Plaque Pod. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please subscribe, leave a positive rating and review, and share this episode far and wide with people you think might enjoy it. You can follow the podcast on Instagram and Twitter at Blue Plaque Pod. I'm on Instagram as at Cassia Writes and on Twitter as at Cassia Sinclair. This episode was hosted by me, Cassia Sinclair, editing and audio production by Rob Burney at Made by DBM. The theme tune is Dawning Sprite by Lincoln Davis.